This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. The goal of education is to engage students with appropriately challenging materials. But what is the role of schools when students have different levels of academic aptitude? The dilemma of choosing between gifted versus special needs programs to allocate limited resources becomes especially pronounced. On the show with me today to explain the role schools can play in nurturing gifted and talented students is Dr. Philip Whitehead, an assistant professor of education, leadership and management. Philip, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Should every school be proactive in identifying the gifted and talented?
I think that's a very important question. And I think it's our responsibility as educators, as teachers, as policymakers and parents to have a very clear view of what schools can actually do given limited resources. But yes, I think that schools have, as part of the DNA, to use a bit of a cliche, the necessity to identify those students who can benefit most from enrichment, from additional activities. But there's a proviso, and that is that we want to think about all learners in every situation. We want to encourage them to maximize their potential.
What would that proactive search look like? I mean, so say schools do have this built into their DNA. It is a part of what they're meant to do. What would that look like while also accommodating, as you say, everybody?
Yeah, I think that a good starting point would be to have a policy which has been thoroughly researched and is evidence-based. And I think the school would need a whole school approach. I said earlier, I think the responsibility is to have quality teachers who are able to detect early signs of talent, early signs of, one might say, genius at times, and have the procedures and processes in place to support teachers, the department, the school, to nurture all of the talent.
How important is it to identify students early on who do need special attention?
I think that again, is a critical issue. From early years, from foundation years education, I think we have a duty to be able to assess and identify those learners who may need support, either in terms of their gift and talentness, in terms of their high performance, potential for high performance, but also those with special needs. And I think it has to start as early as possible, so that resources can be developed and put into place to support the children. And I think it leads into an interesting discussion about the transition from, for example, primary into secondary. One of the things we've learned from our own experience in England is that you need to have a very persistent dialogue between teachers in both phases so that information about individual learners is passed on and is acted upon. So that if I'm teaching Class A on the first day of the new term, I've got very good, deep knowledge about each of my students and can plan accordingly to provide the opportunity for them to maximise their talent ability.
What kind of information needs to be passed along? Because, of course, information in this case is very subjective. You know, a student that I view as difficult might not be in someone else's class.
I'm going to make an apology. I've been in this country just about 10 weeks. I'm not very au fait with the system. So I'm talking about experience from working with and in English schools. But essentially, there is national data when children, young people, learners have sat national tests. So there's that kind of data. But I think there's also, as you've suggested, there is qualitative data, which may be subjective. But that judgment from the form tutor, from the pastoral tutor, I think is very important, also from parents and other educators in a general sense. I think there needs to be, it's almost like a case study situation for each child so that every opportunity can be maximised.
How likely are gifted children to be misdiagnosed as difficult learners because people don't understand what giftedness can look like?
Yeah, I think that again is so important in the learning journeys for every child. The system, in inverted commas, needs to ensure that teachers, educators, other professionals such as healthcare professionals are clued in to what to be looking for with children. And inevitably there will be some children who do appear to be problematic to some of their teachers if their behaviour is not what has been expected. They might be threatening in some way to teachers if their subject knowledge is greater, or if they show particular contrariness, or if they are striving too much for perfection. If we have good systems in place for initial teacher training, we have good systems in place within the schools, then I think we can go some way to trying to deal with that kind of difficult issue about diagnosis.
We've been talking primarily about primary and secondary education, point of time, but is a gifted student's potential too late to realise once he or she has moved beyond those points?
Again, that's a fascinating area. I'm reminded about a piece of research that was carried out many years ago in England, and it was simply called 15,000 Hours, and it represents the journey from someone entering the education system in the formal sense to leaving. During that period, I think we should be able to pick up and identify learners at different stages and different phases. A young girl who starts her education in primary might not blossom and flourish in a particular area, a particular aptitude, ability, until much later in the secondary curriculum. And I think we need to have the resources, the provision of ready, so that we can support that young learner.
So in theory then, once that young learner has been identified, what is the responsibility of the school, in your view, to support them? I mean, what would that infrastructure look like?
I've said already that there should be a clear-cut policy. It should be transparent, and it should be available to all members of staff, department, to parents as well, and to children themselves. And then there are various strategies. I think that any school which is really keen on supporting their high-potential, high-performing students can develop a range of initiatives. So we might, for example, include enrichment activities. But I would want to say that most children should have the opportunity to take part in these. It might be out-of-school activities. It might be opportunities to use work of someone like De Bono, Gardner's Multiple Intelligence, to create lessons. And this is where I think the main point comes over, to create lessons which are interesting, which attract all learners, that can get them involved, enthused, and want to learn. I keep saying, we've got to think about quality teachers. We've got to think about appropriate training for them so that they can be in a position to deliver opportunities for every child.
What do we know about the learning styles of the gifted, and how best to accommodate or adapt to that?
I think I've suggested that I would want to see a school where children aren't segregated out because they have a particular way of learning. I think we ought to be comprehensive in our attempts to explore different learning styles, different strategies, particularly different teaching learning strategies with all pupils. As I said earlier, though, it may be that some students have a particular idiosyncrasy, which may be a bit challenging to some teachers. Teachers should be able to work through those kind of issues with their colleagues, with other experts who they can bring in. So it's not a case of, what's the word to use? It's not a case of trying to negate that particular issue related to a child with a particular talent or ability. It's a chance to build on it, to make it not as a threat, but to turn it into an opportunity.
And how would that fit into a classroom of, say, 20 students, where you want to include one student and nurture them without, as you say, negating their talents, but you also want to be able to give attention and a proper learning structure to the other 19 or the other 18 students in that class?
Some people might say that this isn't a difficult situation. I think what we're beginning to talk about is the idea of differentiation, that within a classroom there are multiple talents and abilities, and that we as teachers, professionals, we need to be able to produce engaging, invigorating materials, content that allows all students to achieve maximum, within a 35, 40-minute lesson. And it's our duty to plan carefully so that we can produce the activities which will engage all of our learners.
Why is it so important to not have that kind of segregation when it comes to giftedness or special needs? Why is it important to have everybody be in the same space and learn together?
I think there's some very good evidence that, for example, peer-to-peer learning can be a very viable and productive tool for teachers to use in the classroom. I would want to argue that all children have particular strengths, and we should be providing the opportunity to think about those strengths and to use whatever resources in the classroom, and that means using our students as well, our learners, to use their strengths to help co-construct lessons, to work on innovative teaching strategies with each other, with the teacher. And I think what in my experience anyway, which is limited to English schools, I guess, where the teacher can stand back from being the fountainhead of all knowledge at the front, where the teacher can be a facilitator. I've used the word co-construction. I've seen great examples in Denmark where teachers, parents and the students come together to plan the next term's curriculum. Isn't that wonderful? And I think, you know, it might be idealistic, but I think those things can happen, even within, I'm not going to say the straitjacket, within the confines somewhat of a national curriculum.
Well, I mean, as you pointed out, your experience is primarily, you know, from working in England, but that is also where we inherited our education system. And
very good point.
Yes, and when I'm listening to the classroom that you're describing, it looks nothing like the classroom that I grew up in. Mm. And certainly, when I think about the school that I know, right. My school that I came up from, that kind of interaction and that kind of back and forth just doesn't exist or didn't exist then. Does it require a huge change of mindset to get used to, you know, a less sort of patriarchal, less top-down kind of approach?
I think that's an interesting way of describing the system. You're opening up what to me is a, you know, a universal and demanding question at present. We are very interested in international comparisons of achievement. I think the Malaysian Education Blueprint has taken heed of performance of Malaysian school learners in particular schools. We're certainly doing that in England. There's an opportunity here to learn from other countries, but be very aware that each system has its own particular culture, its own particular context. We can't just simply borrow a policy from one country and enact it in another country. So, for example, you may have seen in England recently we've invited Chinese mathematics teachers to come over to England, teach in a secondary school, to raise achievement, to break down barriers amongst learners in terms of their performance. Some success. I've seen examples from other countries where policymakers seem perhaps too reliant on what has been successful in other countries. And I think your opening question to me here in this part of the interview, there needs to be change, but I'm aware that parents will be very concerned that their children are still getting the opportunities to gain maximum marks in their test. In a national curriculum with national testing, then we have to have a balance. We can't experiment with children's lives. We're in systems throughout the world now which are very much focused on attainment in particular types of academic ability. I noticed in the blueprint there's wonderful opportunity there to start thinking about other aptitudes and talents, such as teamworking, such as a public spirit, such as cooperative learning. These things are written within the blueprint. Are we going to be able to find ways of assessing children other than in their mathematical, their scientific, their linguistic abilities? Can we look for a space to identify those areas? And I think the PISA tests, OECD, I think they are starting to look at, I'm going to say, 21st century skills. Communication, critical thinking, creativity, all those are very important. How can you actually build those into a dynamic, engaging and interesting curriculum? That's a challenge for us all, I think.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Philip Whitehead, an assistant professor of education, leadership and management. And we're talking about the role of schools in nurturing giftedness. And giftedness here, we're talking about gifted learners. Next, we find out whether the challenge of nurturing gifted children is at all similar to that of integrating students with learning disabilities. You're listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Tree Lin. In the studio with me, Dr. Philip Whitehead, an assistant professor of education, leadership and management. We're talking about the role of schools in nurturing giftedness. Now, we've covered We've covered roughly that, actually, the role of the school, how teachers can play a role in communication, parents could play a role as well. Mm. But we've also talked about limited resources. And is the challenge of nurturing gifted children in our education system similar to that of integrating students with special needs or learning disabilities?
Again, I'm not clear about the picture in Malaysia about how resources are distributed. I think from a democratic point of view, one would want to argue that a well-led system, well-led schools would be able to ensure that resources are distributed and used in an inclusive and effective manner. And again, I'd go back to the idea about securing achievement for all learners, no matter what the starting point is. So again, I know there would be huge issues for schools in different parts of the country, rural and urban schools, for example. School policy is incredibly important. The role of governors is important in deciding on the distribution of resources. But also, of course, policymakers have to make a huge commitment to send the resources for gifted and talented high performers and children with different learning needs.
Not to get into semantics, but according to the National Association for Gifted Children, giftedness is an inward state of being, while talent is an outward manifestation of giftedness. What does it take to translate giftedness into talent, to get it to outwardly manifest?
I was thinking about this. Recently, we've seen the sad news about the death of someone like Muhammad Ali, the boxer. Want to discuss, was this a great talent? Was some with particular gifts? How do you actually identify talents such as his early on?
And he didn't do well within the education system either.
He didn't, although he had a propensity towards poetry, I think. Whether he had formal tuition in that, I don't know. But I think it's taking the identifying that particular seed which can be nurtured and which can be developed. I think there's a lot of hard work in terms of coaching, in terms of mentoring, to support the development of that particular, I'm going to say, the gift into a talent. And I think too often, because of some of the issues we discussed earlier, children's talent and their gifts indeed are ignored, denied. And we're missing huge opportunities, with our young learners, and to give them the opportunity to maximise their potential.
Might we need to accept that in some cases there are going to be people who will fall through the cracks? Because what I'm Absolutely. Hearing in some ways is that, if the argument is that everybody has a gift of sorts, that everybody has their own set of talents, and that those talents could be supported within the education system, but our system itself probably can't accommodate, you're good at math, we'll help you be good at math, you're good at art, you're good at boxing. It's a difficult thing to try and reach everyone. So do we just need to accept that within the formal education system, such as it is, we might need to accept that there will be cracks?
I take your point very, very earnestly. Parents and carers out there listening might be saying, I want my child to have every opportunity to have their gifts, their talents, their abilities supported. I think it does come back again to a question of commitment from politicians, from policymakers, to resources. There are going to be some children who slip through the net. We have a really interesting history in the UK about our position about testing and identifying and selecting children. We have to be thinking, as we said earlier, about ways of ensuring that children get, I'm not going to say second chance, but, the late developer, the person who perhaps is not fitted into the school system, gets a chance later on to have their abilities, I'm going to say, use the word maximise there.
Is it feasible to divide classes according to aptitude instead of biological age, as we're currently doing?
Again, I think that's a fascinating question. I think we'd want to argue it's the stage of development at which a young child is. Would it be possible to have a system whereby we don't have children blocked into classrooms by their age? I think there have been systems tried throughout history, where we've educated children of all ages, all types, all abilities under one roof. And there are, very good examples of that. Within a system such as we have in most countries today, that's quite difficult, I think, to move away from an age-focused setup, we've already said, you know, there are children who do not perform the same as their peers at a particular age. And, you know, it's so difficult within the system that we have now to change that. But I don't think we should be despondent. I think, you know, change can happen. If we think back to what the system was like, you know, 50 years, 20 years ago, then there have been great strides forward. But again, I think it comes down often to a political decision. But you have to take careful consideration into account of your, a horrible word, consumers and clients, you know, so what parents and carers are thinking. It's a difficult issue, it really is difficult.
And when the word political has entered our conversation now, and it could be argued that the idea of having a gifted and talented program taking up resources that could be going to children who are struggling in school, it just seems distasteful to some. It seems elitist, it seems discriminatory. You know, how would you respond to that?
I think that's an issue which we've been grappling with in England for over a century and a half. Rigorous forms of testing. I think there are big issues about what we are testing and the systems used to test people, to allocate them to particular learning groups. I think that there are going to be considerable problems moving away from systems which are based on you know, quite traditional forms of assessment. Your education blueprint starts looking at those different opportunities. Some children can be coached to the test, teachers teach to the test. Is this right? You know, I think that's not quite the correct word to use, but is this a way of working in a democratic society that we should be not offering the same opportunity for all learners at all times in all provision? I think that's something which we are grappling with and still have to grapple with.
And when it comes to inequality in school, another way in which it manifests is that children from privileged socioeconomic backgrounds usually, by and large, do better than their disadvantaged peers in early IQ testing. Is this something that can be overcome?
I think IQ testing is a very controversial and contested area.
Yeah.
And a great deal has been written about the value of the IQ test. What does it actually test? We've come around in our system, and many other countries have too, trying to develop tests which can capture many, many different types of ability. One way of overcoming the rigidity of some of these tests is to find ways of recognising disadvantage to promote opportunities for learners who don't do so well in those kind of formal tests. For example, in England, there's a very interesting initiative, Pupil Premium, which gives children from poorer backgrounds, particularly from rural, from some inner city areas, more resource. The resource follows them through the schooling. I think also we've invested the ideas of having priority areas in education, actual physical areas where you can put more resource, attract better teachers, better leadership. And that is all to combat the idea, not the idea, the fact that, you know, many students who benefit from a particular form of testing, such as that based on IQ testing, do come from a particular background, which tends to be more privileged than the majority of students. I refer back to a point I made earlier. We talked to a wastage of talent. We need to have the facilities and resources to support all those unique individual learners throughout their learning journeys.
Right now, if parents feel like mainstream education isn't helping their children learn effectively, if it just doesn't seem to be fitting in a way that that reflects the, you know, the intelligent, curious child they see at home seems to be having a lot of difficulty at school, what are their options? What are their options to help make this an easier journey for their kid?
I interpret that question some way in saying that, you know, parents have a great responsibility to provide support for their children. What can they do to help support their children if they feel that the school isn't doing as much as it should be doing?
Yes, and also, are there alternatives other than that, other than school?
Yes,
I guess.
I think I'd want to highlight initially, you know, the out of school experience. I just come from a conference for Malaysian English language teachers, Melta Conference in Ipoh, where I've seen some fantastic examples of work done by enthusiastic and knowledgeable teachers outside the classroom. It doesn't have to happen within the classroom. And I guess we've hinted at 20th century curriculum, 20th century skills. There's so much information available to learners, to parents, to communities out there. What we need to be is mindful of being able to evaluate the quality of those resources which are out there. One example from, I just know of an example where university is working with students to develop their research skills and is doing this in such an informed and interesting way, giving them project-based learning, which they're doing in their own time. They come and present a report, they do research. Parents can get involved in that as well. I think parents need to be skilled. They need support. I think the school can have a policy which encourages parents to support their children. But they have to be very, very focused in terms of the materials which they can pull out of the air, so to speak.
Right now, looking around the educational space, what innovations in alternative learning models excite you?
I think that's a great question to ask. Just coming back from this conference, I've seen so many examples of a very interesting work, combining new technologies with classroom and out-of-classroom experiences. I think those activities, I know of one initiative at the National Institute, Selangor, where I've been there with the silver and pewter, a collection of silver and pewter. People are developing ways of working with students, interactive ways with the technology, in ways which I think capture the imagination of young learners and give them opportunities to explore, you know, in a hands-on way, in a constructive way, they're learning with their peers. But in the natural environment of a museum or a gallery, there's so much work that can be done in those areas. I'm also very interested in kind of very simple ideas, such as, you know, Dweck suddenly appeared on scene, Carol Dweck, with her views about mindsets. Sometimes I think some of these ideas are not new. When we think about the 21st century curriculum, we think about critical thinking and creativity. I'd like to think that these things have been going on since we first started educating children in informal ways. They're not new, but suddenly they become the focus of attention. I think we've got to take heed of these different approaches, bearing in mind that we said we're working with the constraints of often a national curriculum, a national testing. We still need to think creatively about, you know, providing opportunities for all learners within those situations, not to provide quick fixes which look great on paper and are using all kinds of fads and gimmicks to engage learners. There has to be real evaluation of these different approaches, evidence-based.
You're going to be speaking, from what I understand, at the National Association for Gifted Children Malaysia's Gifted and Talented Conference. Could you tell us a little bit about what you'll be speaking on?
Yeah, I think I've touched on some of those issues already.
You haven't given it all away?
too eagerly, too enthusiastically. I think I want to look at particular examples where schools, and I am focusing really on English schools, where they have made tremendous strides. Schools, often in underprivileged areas, in deprived areas, where they've developed the policy which encourages opportunities for all learners, and, you know, particular strategy within the classroom, within the school, where we're engaging, you know, teams of enthusiastic teachers, parents, learning assistants, the community, local politicians, and the school governors, of course. So I want to think about practical ways in which we can give parents, carers, community members ways of enhancing opportunities. And I've just got one lovely experience to share there. I was in a school community very, very recently, last week, and it was to celebrate the work of very young people. And there were young kids, I'm going to call them kids, who were dancing, singing, playing musical instruments, doing all manner of things on stage for the first time. And they'd been prepared by the community, they'd been prepared by their mums and grandparents. And it was just a fantastic and enriching experience. On Saturday, I was watching a theatre production of 1001 Nights by a group of students. And I was thinking, can we see those young children I saw in this village up in the north? Can we see those children in a university, you know, producing the goods, so to speak? Will they fall through the net? I think with that community where you've got parents, you've got carers, and you've got grandparents working together, we can do it. We can achieve success for all.
Philip will be speaking at the Gifted and Talented Conference organised by the National Association of Gifted Children Malaysia on Saturday, June 18th. For more information on that, you can email contact@nagc.my. Philip, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
I've been speaking today with Dr. Philip Whitehead, an Assistant Professor of Education, Leadership and Management. Together we've been talking about the proper way to support, or the best way rather, to support and nurture gifted learners. You've been listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.